But the greatest factor in the last analysis is the grit and the determination, what a man is in the depths of himself. I don't have a word for it. Can anybody help me? An athlete would know this.
Endurance.
It's the kind of thing I read to the class the other day, the statement of Muhammad Ali training for one of his final fights in the late 1970s, where he was of an age where he was in excruciating pain in his training program. He said, and yet I must force my body. It's killing me. I'm tasting death. I'm tasting my blood. But I cannot consider losing. I cannot live with defeat. Whatever it takes, I must win, even if this training is stretching me to the uttermost. In a word, what made Ali great and every great athlete is that indefinable thing that I'm trying to hint at in the word grit. It's that determination, it's that will, it's that what a man is in himself. That, and I've played ping pong with a number of good players over the years. One of the highlights of my memories on the troop ship going to Germany was the coming back. I was losing 19-12. And the guy was of Italian descent. And I said, we Jews have been your victims historically. Rome destroyed Jerusalem. But I'm going to call for something ancestral to win. And I beat him 21-19. On the basis, and I think the man had superior skills, but I had a greater determination and grit not to lose. So wrestling, there's something of wrestling where deep really meets deep. Jacob wrestled with the man. It's God in his deeps wrestling with the man in his deeps. And something has got to come out of that, of a transcendent kind that will affect all the future. Jen?
I think this is why some of the last words that Jesus has to say to the church, in fact to every church in Revelation, is that we must overcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's part of what the word Israel itself means, as we come. How many of us have wrestled with the scriptures? Mm-hmm. We need to learn what wrestling means. Mm-hmm. Of investing ourselves in something to the uttermost. And where your mind is clouding up or other distractions of a legitimate kind have a claim on you, you persist. You're ruthless in your determination against yourself to see something through to the end.
Those who endure to the end will be saved.
Right. Yeah. Good. Praise the Lord. Hey, this shows a remarkable corroboration with the New Testament in the last few verses that I've been quoted. And why should it not? I mean, this is one God and his one book. So Jacob was left alone, and the man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, we have to follow these pronouns. And one time he is referring to God, and another time he is referring to Jacob. So when we read in verse 26, he said, let me go, for the day breaks, it's God speaking. But he said, Jacob, I will not let you go unless you bless me. You know what I have to say about Jacob? I love him. You know what I have to say about Jacob? God loves him. You know why? Because whatever he is a schemer, a supplanter, a wheeler-dealer, cunning in his ways, I will not let you go except you bless me. This statement, what this touches, what this expresses, is so dear in God's sight. This determination, this jealousy, is of the kind that takes the kingdom. The kingdom of God suffers violence, and the violent take it by force. It is not an invitation to physical violence, but to a violence of will, of determination, and of spirit. This is why Watchman Nee says, and I read to the class, at the end of his book, Love Not the World, that it's one thing to evangelize, but when it comes to confronting the principalities and the powers of the air, something is required of yet another kind, of an utterness toward God spiritually, an utterness where the last thing is pulled out. It's why are we struggling for words? Because we don't have a vocabulary for this, because it's outside of our experience, because nothing in the world incites or encourages this kind of intensity of determination and will but God himself. Whatever can be said about Jacob that is negative, this one thing, this one redeeming thing, maybe this was it. This was the pivot. Maybe if he had given up or let go, or he felt himself mastered, or how can I win in a situation like this? This man is overpowering me. Jacob would not have become Israel. But when he said, I will not let you go, except that you bless me. What if we came to this school with such an attitude as that? Lord, I'm not going to leave until I have received the uttermost from you in these days. It's beyond the issue of who the teachers are. I want to draw this out of your heart. or these men in Illinois, I'm not quitting. I don't care how disappointed I am, how angry this letter has made me be, how snubbed I feel, how racially put down, whatever it is, I'm sticking this through. I'm going to face this. I will not let this go until it becomes a blessing. I will not. There's something there that is at the heart of what God is after, and maybe at the heart of what distinguishes Israel.
Should not that be that the death will occur? A lot of us say a prayer, but is it something that we're trying to just get a hold of God, or we're asking God to get a hold of us?
Well, I think it's prayers that go beyond words, mm-hmm. and groanings that cannot be uttered, mm-hmm. is the prayer of the kind we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Because words, we've said all that can be said, but we've not yet fully come to the issue and seeing it through. There's something that lies too deep for words, and that needs to be transacted out of spirit in groanings that cannot be uttered, that it even comes to us by the Spirit of God when we have come to the ground of God, beyond petition, beyond words, beyond thoughts, beyond what we can ask or say. Most of us stop short. The great prayers are not prayed, because we don't go through, we don't endure to the end. The same thing is true of the church. We quit too soon, right? Not only our prayer, but our relationships. The going gets tough, we're looking for another greener pasture, or they dump the pastor to get someone who will be less demanding. But this spirit, I will not let you go.
What can it be experienced unless you're in the cellar? Yeah. If it's not midnight, you know, I don't know that unless God creates the situation likewise, yeah. that you can really experience it.
Right.
You can't just say one day, hey, everything's going great. You know,
there's no occasion to experience it.
Yeah, it's crisis when you are in the valley.
Requires it. Crisis makes it possible. Crisis is a blessing. Mm-hmm. It's painful. It's excruciating. Mm-hmm. It's mind-boggling. It's full of fear and trembling, but Would we have come to this place of the deeps, even the deeps of ourselves that we had not even known and recognized as being there, except that crisis had brought us to it? So the question for us is, would we welcome a crisis that brings us to such a place? What are we transacting with God? What are we saying to him? To what degree, I don't want to get biographical, Moshe Rosen predicted, no, Moshe Rosen is the head of Jews for Jesus. I was recruited out of high school teaching by Moshe Rosen, who at that time was the head of recruiting and training for the American Board of Missions for the Jews, a Baptistic organization. He brought me out of the teaching profession. I was the first Pentecostal ever to be brought into that Baptist organization. And over the course of that training period, he said one time publicly, he said, by the time you're 50, Art, you'll be the Jewish Billy Graham. It's never happened. Instead, I found myself out in the boondocks, in Nowheresville, LaPorte, Minnesota, because somewhere along the line, I think I remember having prayed, Lord, whatever it takes, please reserve me for your true, final, last day's work. So I'm asking, what are we transacting with God and what are we asking? Because to say whatever it takes is to say, whatever crisis is required, I invite you to bring it. And maybe we're not coming to that crisis, over which threshold we would have been moved from Jacob to Israel is because we have not welcomed crisis and let the Lord know that we're willing for the crisis alone that would bring it.
Maybe we also have not come into this kind of word that can then bring this that relationship that can take us to that.
Good. I'm glad you said that, because that's probably the object of what this prophetical school is about, is to bring the crisis of the word. The whole school is a crisis because we don't even know how we're proceeding day by day. Now, we had a brother leave yesterday who left in disappointment because the school was not what he had hoped for. What he thought it was going to be was some mentoring, some bringing him into his ministerial call, that he's been told that he has a prophetic call in his life, and he thought the school would be the instrument by which that prophetic call would be realized. Instead, we went into this subject and that subject, and it was not specifically addressed to ministerial fulfillment. And we Americans like to be ministerially fulfilled. We are ambitious for the fulfillment of our ministries and not as attentive to the character of life. That has to be the foundation for that which is prophetic and apostolic and true. And so he left yesterday and missed today what might have been a word that would have revealed the condition of his mind and heart and his ambition and brought him to a crisis by which he might have sent all things over, including his ambition to be a prophet. And by that so doing would have been the very ground for the attainment of that. Because Jacob wanted the spiritual things of God. That's why he cheated his brother. It would have been given him. Because Jacob was from the beginning the choice of God. Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated. And what is the, how, in a nutshell, what can we say of the history of the nation Israel? A seeking by its own effort and its own striving to obtain what God himself would have given had it let go and let God be God, including the state of Israel itself. Instead of a Zionist presumption and by funds and violence and cunning and all these mechanisms to obtain, what have they got? Threat, the possibility of collapse, intifadas, stone throwing, a nation within the nation that is onto the teeth and ready to do them in within their own boundaries, and circled by hostile Arabs with missile and germ warfare capability and poison gas. That's what you get when you seek to do it for yourself. So the whole struggle of God with Jacob has been to let Jacob let go. Relinquish your grasp on the heel and let God give you what you would have obtained had you not striven.
Has not two things usually always happened all that type of a crisis in Israel? Either they totally gave up and were taken back into captivity, or they repented and sought God.
Well, the hopeful repentance follows. So, remembering Dan's sharing the other night, you who are far off, and repeat myself with again, into the commonwealth of Israel. Not to some mythical thing, but an actual substantial thing. We're talking about us. When we talk about Israel, we're talking about ourselves. And it's the whole of Israel that God is wanting to bring forth. So we're not just examining something that pertains to them. We're examining something that pertains to us. This is a crisis being brought by the word. And if I can say this freely, and I believe I can, Reg. For no one is the crisis greater than the black believer. Because everything in history and in society presses upon them to succeed on the basis of their own ability. After being long submerged and held down, everything that is human, every corpuscle cries out for recognition and fulfillment by others, particularly by the oppressor, that I can do it too. And for God to say, for you to relinquish, and for you to let go, and to let God, and take the lower place until God himself will give. Talk about crisis.
I abhor the excellency of Jesus. That pride and that self-reliance and that talent and that thrift, I think, relates to all of us in the valley.
Yep.
That, I mean, until you become Israel, I hate all this that you rely on. Until you turn, leave everything, withhold nothing, I abhor that.
Well, we all know how many trips we made to the altar on these altar calls, and somehow Jacob stubbornly remains alive. So may the Lord bring us. Maybe all of that was preparation for a time, a moment that would come when the deepest realization would strike our heart, and that we would let go of that last thing so deep you can't even identify it. But you'll not know it till there's a cry. Jacob wept.
I need to share this, that there was a message given at our church about Jacob. And it was given completely different. Uh-huh. It was given celebrating Jacob's ability to, it was exactly the opposite. Yeah. Celebrating the fact that he grabbed the hold of the Jesus. More the emphasis on one who grabs a hold of, as opposed to the planting aspect. That was completely pushed to the side for this other side to be emphasized. Yeah.
It may well be that not the least of the witness to the Jewish people in the last days is the revelation of what Israel means as they will behold it in the black believer. Because we Jews who have a common history of being oppressed and held down and so on, there's always been a arc of sympathy and identification. When we see in the black believer a freedom from the necessity to succeed or to be recognized succeeding, and a people who can relinquish and even relinquish their own life for the Jew, there's a black brother in Washington, D.C., who says, I believe in that scripture in Isaiah, I've given many men for you, I've given life of many for you, and then it says, Ethiopia and Cush, that somehow there'll be a requirement from the black believer to the point of the actual giving of their lives for the Jews in the last days. That will be such a demonstration to them of what it means to be Israel, the life laid down, and the life that is limp, that is permanently crippled, that refuses to succeed on the basis of its own strength. And even as I say that, when I think of black athletes who are supreme in virtually every category, precisely on the basis of their supreme strength and ability, to allow yourself to be made halt there, to be crippled in the orb of the hip, the socket, the nexus where your power is, and your virility, because that's the same part of the body that contains your sexual organs, your manhood, your masculinity, your sexuality, and I'm told that it's in the socket of the hip that the blood cells are themselves produced. So this was not the man who wrestled with Jacob just aimlessly touching something he could reach. He went with great accuracy to the nexus, N-E-X-U-S, of what makes Jacob Jacob. And there he crippled him. And he crippled him permanently. Jacob that does not limp is not Israel. If we're still striding without a limp and carrying the day and coming through on our own basis, we're yet Jacob and not yet Israel. Limping is halting. Limping is a continual, fixed-in, permanent reminder that your strength is not in yourself. That you're weak and disabled. And except that God be your provision, you shall not prosper. You shall not succeed in the thing in which you are about. And the thing which you are about is an ultimate thing. God doesn't give to Israel small things. He gives ultimate things to be his statement in the earth and to the nations in the last days, and to bring in the people Jacob, that they might become the Israel of God also. He gives us an ultimate thing beyond any ability in ourselves to perform it, and all the more even reduces us by crippling us to guarantee that it will not be performed on the basis of our ability. And you want that voluntarily? You want what came to Jacob inadvertently? You're welcoming intentionally? That's the church. So, 26. Let me go for the day breaks. This has all got to be accomplished that night. Nothing left over. When the dawn comes, something new has got to be established, or it will not come again. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Jacob understands that the word blessing is not a cliche. It's something that maybe we don't understand. Bless you, brother. I bless you. Bless you, my Lord. Bless, 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 bless. I don't know of another word that has been so cheapened, so robbed of its meaning, than the word bless. If I had any authority, you know what I would do? I would call a moratorium. It would be forbidden for the next year to use the word bless until it can come again into the focus and meaning and intention of God who gave it. The word bless is a divine word that describes a divine phenomenon, and we need to esteem what it means to bless and to be blessed. A lot of what we're suffering is the want of blessing that would come to us by those who know the word and bestow it by faith upon us in their prayer. Now, when I say, bless you, brother, it's not a little pat on the back making nice. It's not placating. It's conferring. It's enduing. It's establishing. Can you imagine that we have that authority and that we fall short of it because we've allowed the word to fall into such a low place of insignificance because we've not wrestled to keep its meaning and its value. When Jacob said, I will not let you go except you bless me, God knew that Jacob knew what he was saying. He wasn't asking for a little pat on the back. He was asking for the deepest conferring of something that must come from God, that can't even be defined or identified, but changes everything. It's being imbued with something from God that affects everything that you are in Him. I will not let you go except you bless me with that blessing. God waits to be constrained. Remember the two disciples on the road to Emmaus? They were disappointed, again disappointed. We thought it had been He who had restored the glory of Israel. Jesus walking with them in the way, and his face was hidden to them. They didn't recognize him. And they came to their house, and he made as if he was going to go on. But they constrained him to come in. And when he came in and broke bread, their eyes there were opened. We're not constraining God, guys. Every prophetical school is different. Every day of it is different. Every session of it. Everything depends on the knit of that school, the coming of the personalities, what God has assembled, and to what degree we are constraining God and saying in our spirit, we will not let you go except you bless us. Lord, I'm only here from Monday to Friday, but I want to go back to Indiana differently than the man that came. I'm asking you to pull out the stuffs. I know it's going to cost, because to whom much is given, much is required. But I don't want to just be faintly blessed and think, those were lovely days. I really enjoyed that. I learned something. I understand. I want something more. An impartation of God that will enable me to function as Israel and not a Jacob drawn from himself. And I'll not let you go except you bless me. This is the kind of spirit that characterized the church of olden times that had their all-night prayer times, prayer sessions. They wouldn't let go until the dawn, until the day came, through the night, wrestling with God. That was my experience in Uganda, in Africa, preaching at 4 o'clock in the morning for a second or third time, as we had an all-night session with the saints. The next morning, I could hit the sack and rest. But they went to work, up all night, and I'm not satisfied with a 30, 40-minute sermon. More, more. Tell us more. Give us more. More. And you preach 2, 3, 4, 5 times through the night with prayers, agonizing, crying out to God, experience not to be forgotten.
It seems said by certain commentators, I don't know if you agree, but 90 was a dread. Hebrews says it will be great tribulation. And it's interesting that the wrestling with God is all taking place at night. And as I look at the text, I'm not sure if you would agree, but I see kind of like a prophetic word that the church itself will wrestle in the night with God, representative of the tribulation to come, not only for Israel, but also for the church, but also for us as believers, that our wrestling must come during tribulation itself. And as the day breaks, that's when we seek the blessing of God. And I see this like a prophetic thing that's rising up out of the scripture.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's not something that Jacob would have come to out of his own purpose apart. However noble the time that might have been, although God planted and prepared something in Jacob, that this particular crisis was perfectly suited and calculated to produce. Jacob was in, this was not something that he had espied as a great blessing of God. He was in a struggle for life and death. The blessing or the not blessing of the angel meant whether or not he would survive the following day. And so it's like when the disciples said, to whom shall we go? He alone had the words of life. This is not the statement of strength or human resolve or some nobility. This is the statement of utter desperation that God himself has orchestrated. And to bring this man to an end of everything of his own reliance. And so, I like what the brother said, you know, so often we celebrate Jacob's noble resolve, and yet that was a noble resolve that never came without being an issue of life and death. Jacob knew something of the promise in his glorious beginnings with God, but to really come to the utterance that was required to inherit the promise, only God could bring him to that place. He would never have chosen. And I don't want to over-reiterate, but it's like when Peter, when Jesus said to Peter, when you were young, you girded yourself, but when you were old, another will gird you and take you where you were not. This whole transaction with God is something that Jacob in himself would not. But God had appointed it. In fact, Paul said in Romans 9, I believe it was, that this whole thing had been determined by God before the world began, before Jacob and Esau and Jacob had done either good or evil. So this is something completely orchestrated of God to extract something from Jacob that was planted there by God that would never have been brought to fruition apart from the intervention of God.
So how far will God go to take a Jacob and make him an Israel? Very far. Even to the threat of extinction. Because what waited him when the dawn broke was Esau with his company of 400 men. It was disaster ahead. But you're right, he's not asking for a little patsy blessing. He's asking for life and death blessing that will enable him to face the crisis. And when he receives that blessing, he faces the crisis in an entirely new way. Let's look at that. When he finally does meet Esau, Chapter 33, now, after that night, Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming. What a frightful sight that must have been. And with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants, And he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and Rachel and Joseph last. Rachel and Joseph were the dearest to him, mm-hmm. and he puts them in the most protected place. Then he crossed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. So, unless we can visualize this, this would take some mighty depiction on a film, on a screen, how formidable Esau and the 400 men, the terrifying fright of what they represented, the prospect of complete annihilation, which is exactly what world Jewry is going to face at the time of Jacob's trouble. It's not getting out of a little scrape, but the prospect of total annihilation, that's what faced Jacob. By a man who has had time to nurture, nurse, and cultivate his vengeance. And then he bows himself 7 times. What's the word for that?
Obeisance.
There's a way in which you can do that is calculated to please men and to ease them of their vengeance. But there's a way in which you can do that is honest and that really expresses a respect and an honor. The fact that it was done 7 times, is there anything insignificant in Scripture? Why didn't they do it 2 or 3 times? Isn't that enough? I think I've gone a whole lifetime of over 70 years. I don't know that I've ever bowed before a man once. 7 times. It's almost like a statement of repentance. It's an inarticulated statement of body language that is saying to Esau, I'm aware of what I did to you, and I took advantage of you, and I'm acknowledging my fault and my sin against you. And something like that, an acknowledgement of sin, of transgression against another, diffuses the anger and the resentment that would otherwise have expressed itself as violence. And maybe this is what we're going to have to do to the Arab people. We're going to have to bow before them 7 times. We proud Jews, who have every kind of rationalization of why it is that we had to do this or that, or use violence or imprisonment, to bow before them and acknowledge, we have really done you injury. We have really usurped. We have really used our wits and our power and our strength to defraud you. I'm just speculating. It doesn't say anything like that. But I sense in my spirit, this bowing 7 times was not some genuflection. It was not a mindless obeisance that a man makes in order to get away with something. But something happened to Jacob in the night. He's no longer Jacob. He's now Israel. And he's seeing differently. He's understanding. He's perceiving differently. He's recognizing what the Jacob he in fact was and how much that the wrath of men that is calculated against him is justified in the light of his conniving and usurping action. And this bowing is not a cheap deal. How shall I say this? It's a real humility. This is where it takes God to be a man. Any other humility that does not come from the impartation of God is a false humility. It's a show. It's a self-effacing activity to gain something. It's a it's a salesman's play acting. But I suspect that that was not what Jacob was doing. Something happened to Jacob. There was an infusion of God who says in the New Testament, learn of me, for I am humble and meek. That's what God is in his nature. This is not an affectation that you learn. And this, by the way, is the one thing, in my opinion, that will save us from being seduced by false prophets and false apostles. Because all of these men will make a brave show of being the real thing. They'll know how to say this, they'll know how to say that, they'll quote Paul, they'll have a wonderful ability to do things in the church and heal splits and reconcile and da-da-da-da-da-da. So how can we tell? Because of the phrase that I read from George in Canada, what's his name?
Warnock.
Warnock. in his book, he says, apostolic meekness. And when I saw those two words joined together, something tripped in me. A switch was thrown that has never gone back. That conjunction of apostolic and meekness is the genius of the church and the very nature of God himself. What is Israel? Israel is Jesus. Israel is God. Israel is what God is in himself, conferred into a people who will witness and demonstrate that in their own conduct and walk, however antithetical and opposed it is to the entire spirit of the world. Something happened to Jacob, and the blessing that he received was more than a good feeling. He received the impartation of the life which contains the character of God himself, namely the humility and meekness of God that a Jacob can never know, can never learn, can never obtain, except that it is imparted. But what's a true apostle? One who has such a relationship, such a walk, such a union with God, that the very distinctive attribute that makes God God is expressed in him. And it's not going to come like walking on eggshells. Oh, are you calling on me? I'm not a speaker, please. I don't need to ask you. It's a man who will be forward, uncompromising, stern even, will be requiring, and yet that's humility. We need to be educated in what humility is in the sight of God, and not the kind of thing that men employ to obtain their own ends, where they cuddle up to their wives or their bosses or whatever it is to obtain favor. It's an affectation. It's a show. It's a superficial overlay. True meekness and humility is through the cookie all the way. It's the essential character of God himself. And if the church doesn't have it, it should not call itself the Israel of God. The fact that we have not won over the Jew by our witness and moved them to jealousy is the very evidence that we do not have it. The fact that we thought that we ourselves were their successors and that we are the Israel of God and God is finished with them is the very evidence that we don't have it. It's arrogance, it's presumption, it's anything but humility. Humility is the name of the game. And you can't be the first one in your neighborhood to have it by sending in your box top. You have it to the degree that you have God, or more accurately, to the degree to which God has you. And I'm not boasting that I have it in any substantial measure, but this much I know, to the degree that I do have it by virtue of that union, it is always misconstrued and invariably misunderstood by men who are on the other side of resurrection and is perceived as being arrogant. If there's one catcall and offense that for which I'm frequently charged, is arrogance. How dare you say that? Who are you to say? Who do you think you are? Because you say something with a boldness and an authority. Not because you're a hotshot, but because how can you not say it that God has given it and the moment has come to express it? See what I mean? When Jesus overthrew the money changers' tables, it wasn't that he lost himself for a moment and lost his divine personality and personhood. It was the very expression of it. He was submitting to the Father, because all that he did, he saw from the Father. All that he spoke, he received from the Father. Even the act, the violent act of overthrowing the money changers, was an act of humility. So it does not appear to be that. So what kind of Christians are we? Do we want what appears to men, that we might receive their approval and that our reputations might be secure? Or do we want the true thing, even though it will invite the total misunderstanding of it to our embarrassment or to the loss of our reputation? Isn't that remarkable? The paradoxes of the faith, of what authenticity requires. Because what is apostolic but that which is authentic? And if for the want of that, through the church, that the world is in its present and unhappy condition today. And it's for the want of it that Israel is in her unpleasant condition, and that 2,000 years living in the midst of the church in all nations has not been sufficient to move the Jew to jealousy, for they have not seen what Israel means, as it would, as it should have been profoundly revealed in the Gentile church who had met with God and had been transformed by him and exhibit his very character in life. The Jew is the best. They'll rub you the wrong way. They'll aggravate you and irritate you and see what that brings forth. And you can answer them in kind and give them back in measure and show them who you really are in God and how dare you insinuate or say. But Jesus, when he was railed against, did not rail back. Hanging on the cross and experiencing the unspeakable pain of it and the shame of it, naked, don't think he had that loincloth that the artist paint, naked and not able to cover himself, his hands being nailed, listening to the jeering of his people, come down and we will believe you. If there's ever a statement calculated to say, well, that's it. I've been patient up till now. I've taken your gut up till now. But now let me tell you. I'm here. You know that? He went as a lamb to the slaughter, silently. Not a syllable, not a word, though he was provoked unbearably to say just something to let them know and put them in their place. I tell you that the final issue of the cross, if Jesus had but spoken one word, been provoked, he would have contradicted Isaiah 53. He would not have fulfilled the prophetic foreshadowing, and the world would have been cheated of its Messiah and its deliverer.
I was looking at, in that point, look at Jacob and all of his schemes, the chapter before the 32nd chapter, come and look, you go before me and say this and do this and you do this, all trying to move himself out of the way of that arrow or whatever it is that is going to hit him, right, then he says, using every kind of means he can to move away from that. And the lives, the point you made, that the lives of those that are with him are hanging in the balance.
Yep.
As a result of his, if he doesn't do it as God says do it, then all of the people will die with him.
Right. The stakes are ultimate. So what do you think, that he stayed up late that night or thinking of what his strategy will be in the morning, knowing that he's going to face Esau? How shall I do this? Or was it simply the new man, the transformed man, being there and letting the life that is in him, that is now his life, have its own enactment in whatever form it would take? And I'll tell you, sometimes it'll not be bowing before men, it will be offending them, saying harsh things, as Paul himself did. For example, in Athens on Mars Hill, you philosophers, always seeking God, never coming to the knowledge. I perceive in all things you are too superstitious. Right in the kisser.
Yeah,
telling intellectual men, superstitious. Paul, that's the last and the wrong thing to say. You'll offend your audience. You'll lose them. But Paul had no more preparation or deliberation of what he would speak on this ultimate moment on Mars Hill, where the stakes were enormous. The whole future, Greece, the nation, the scriptures, it's a word to the nations, than Jacob did before Esau on the morning of that confrontation. And that, in fact, is the paradigm of how an Israel of God always proceeds. He never proceeds by calculating his strategy. He simply proceeds, trusting the God who has blessed him with the infusion of his life. So that even this morning, after the lousy night that I had physically, knowing only one thing, that the subject was Israel. That we had to probe how it is that God spoke that and gave that name to Jacob. What meaning? And then proceed. Let the word unfold. So, Israel is a mode of life. It's a way of proceeding. That is described in the limp and being made whole. And we're seeing the first expression of it in facing Esau and bowing seven times. Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him and they wept. That's uncharacteristic of Esau. You should have come upon him and strangled him. But something broke in him, as it invariably will, when the character of God is set forth and displayed before men in humility. The toughest customers will melt and crack and break down when they see that.
This is what I think we were getting at yesterday, when we talked about how the nations will freely bring to Israel.
Right.
All the abundance, because we'll see him as such a meek and converted people. They'll be able to freely regard their state of God.
Humility. True humility disarms aggression, violence, and arrogance. I mean, how can you proceed? It's the demonstration of very God Himself. How can you continue in a vengeful attitude when you've seen this? It diffuses, it empties you, it breaks you. I don't think that this was some phony response on Esau's part. The pity is that he never went on in that. And maybe it was too late having cried those crocodile tears, but here is a remarkably true moment. Esau ran to meet him, embraced him, and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Isn't that beautiful? I look forward to that, when Israel will weep with Esau in the future. They've wept at the life, loss of life, and the explosions in Jerusalem and on the buses and in the marketplaces, and the violence that they have perpetrated one against the other, and the children that they've had to bury as a result of that violence. But let them weep this kind of weeping, and history will be changed. The future will be changed. This is the answer to the Palestinian crisis. That's some dividing of the land, and we'll give you this much to the 13th degree, and you can have this and this, but when men will weep together, that's the end of their aggression, the end of their differences, the end of their ambitions, the end of the things that always eventuated violence. But it was the act of Jacob as Israel that precipitated and broke Esau as they wept together. Can you think of all the church crises that have resulted in splits? And even new denominations and some of these vendettas, they continue through the decades. That should have been resolved this way. They should have wept together and saved the church from being fragmented and splintered.
Do you think this is a requirement of Israel, that they would actually go to the Arab brothers weeping in humility? It would actually break that spirit of the other people. There is something protective in what we're living.
This is the worry that's going to be seen. Mm. That Jews out of Israel will be going to Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Iran and Iraq, and bringing the gospel of the kingdom, but not in some holy arrogance like, now we got it and now we can share it with you, but coming in self-effacing humility and brokenness for the past, the bloodshed, the violence of the past, of which they will acknowledge their own culpability, and defusing the opposition against them, against the message. Why is it that God broke off that branch and grafted in the Gentiles? Why couldn't Israel have been saved initially when Jesus came? Why was he rejected? Because had they received him, then they could have gone forth into the nations and said, him whom we have been awaiting has arrived. The scriptures have fulfilled. He's the King of glory, and his throne is going to be established in our Jerusalem. And we're letting you know that if you want to come, he's bidding you welcome. I don't think there would have been a single Gentile convert, because the arrogance, the religious pride, the self-elevation, our scriptures have been fulfilled. Now, if you want, you can come. It's very different from what the invitation is going to be when a broken Israel, when a broken Jacob has become Israel, will go again to Esau, bowing seven times in humility and weeping, will bring forth a very different response altogether.
You know, if that would have happened when Christ
was
alive, the cross
would never have been taken. Right. Yeah. 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 Christ came by the rejection. You can see that how many things have been served in that. That the nation itself has to go through something by that rejection that will bring them to a final confrontation of night that will fit them to be the Israel of God at last and to be to the nations what they should have been from the first and fulfill God's promise to Abraham to bless all the families of the earth. What a long journey that is. What a Jacob's pilgrimage that this nation has got to fulfill.
And I think also too that the world's perception, church's perception of the cross, I don't think you really see the reality of what we say for it. We see it as a sort of a symbolic path.
It takes a special seal. So, verse 5, he lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, who are these with you? The children whom God has graciously given your servant. And the maidservants came near, they and their children, and bowed down. And Leah also came near with the children, and they bowed down. Afterwards, Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down. And Esau said, what do you mean by all this company which I met? And he said, these are to find favor in the sight of my Lord. He said, what about that gift you sent? All those sheep and camels and stuff that went before me. Is that a payoff? Is that a bribe? No, that's to find favor in your sight. And Esau says, well, I don't want to take it. I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. Jacob said, no, please. If I have now found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have seen your face, as though I have seen the face of God, and you will please me.
Wow.
Isn't it interesting that the thing that had been sent ahead to placate Esau, which was a gift of substantial wealth, camel, sheep, and oxen, those things in that part of the world were wealth. You married a woman and the dowry was three cows or two camels. You know, she was a three camel wife. They measured their wealth in livestock. So he sent forth a formidable present. There's a difference in the spirit in which it was sent forth and how it's to be understood and received. If Esau did not receive the gift, the transaction between them would not have been completed. There would still have been an unanswered question and an agenda that still needed to be faced about the past. The receiving of the gift by Esau was a critically necessary moment. But it was only a payoff and a bribe. He might likely have resisted it. But Jacob, now Israel, persuades him. No, he says, this is a real gift. I'm giving this out of a heart of love. This isn't a payoff. Because when I see your face, it's as if I have seen in the face of God. And here, I don't know what to say. This is the end of comment.
There's something I saw there of him giving out of himself now. Because since these were born of his born and flesh of his flesh. Mm-hmm. And I'm giving this. This is all of me. Mm-hmm. And I'm giving it to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, verse 3 it says, and he passed over before them. Before they, he sent the wives and the children ahead of them. Mm-hmm. Now Israel, he's stepping before them.
Yeah.
And they're behind him.
But does that answer the question of what does he see in Esau's face that he sees the face of God? He should rightly have seen the face of an enemy, the face of an adversary, the face of a man steeped in the desire for vengeance and retaliation. But he doesn't see that at all. He sees the face of God. Is that a play on words? Is he getting poetic here? Or has something happened to Jacob that transfuses and transforms even his seeing? that needs to come to mankind, that you no longer see one as your enemy, but you see him as God sees him, mm-hmm. and sees the potential for him in a way that releases you from fear mm-hmm. and anxiety toward him, and the ability to extend toward him favor and gift out of love.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting prickly sensing, God, but this is drawing like God's heart, guys. You've got to help now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I'm saying. I'm past any understanding of myself. This is more than a little artistic expression. This is an ultimate statement. When you can see in the face of your enemy the face of God.
Mm-hmm. There has to be brokenness for that to happen.
Yeah.
It has to be real. It has to be right
down
to the
bottom. It's the end of all human conflict.
Mm-hmm. 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 Have you been talking to Dad about a book I gave to Katie to watch called The Bait of Satan? Have you heard of it? The woman that sent it to our Bible study wrote along with a little note that said this book should be mandatory reading for every mature Christian, and I agree. It's about the bait of Satan being the bait of taking an offense to their brother. That even in the highest level, as you were speaking of these men who have been meeting, the smallest offense can grow into the largest wall.
Mm-hmm.
The entire book it changed our whole group. It changed everybody's life. American and Kimberly, the bait of Satan is the bait of taking an offense. That's what he does in creating sport in us.
Maybe we should backtrack because there's something hidden here which is suggested. It is to be found in Jacob seeing the angel's face as the face of God revealed to him.
Yeah.
Prior to this encounter, Jacob had his own perception of a God who is mean-spirited perhaps, who has to enter into a commercial transaction with him. If you will bless me, if you will guide me, if you will bring me back to this country, keep me safe, then you will be my God and I will do this for you.
Mm-hmm.
And his perception of God gradually changes and has to be brought to this night where the angel wrestled with God, the angel was allowed to wrestle with him and he was allowed to prevail over the angel.
Mm.
And actually the angel had the potential to crush Jacob all his bones because by just the touch of the angel's hand on the tie, the strength of the man, that tie was dislocated. So the angel actually could destroy him if he wanted to, but the angel did not and allowed him in his human strength to just prevail. There's something that is a paradox, and not only that, but the angel revealed the face of God to Jacob, and Jacob saw that face was not a mean-spirited face, was not a terrorizing face, but face of kindness, of mercy, of forgiveness. And so when he saw Esau having that face of forgiveness and all that, he recalls that face. And I think that's something very rich.
There's another thing. In this, when Jacob sends first the family over, you see the wimp. He's sending the best over, but you have this afraid man sitting there. Then he meets the angel, cries for him, and he rises up on that part with all the characteristics of Jesus Christ. The protector, the provider, the husbandman, the head of the church. And he goes on, passes them, and goes before them as the protector for them, ready to take the battle as Jesus has done for us in the cross of Calvary. That's what I'm feeling.
The precious figure of those last days, as so prophetic, so it's eschatological, it points to the future and the final end of things with Israel and the nations.